Welcome back to another episode of Secrets Behind the Music Business. I'm your host, Barry Victor, and today we have with us a special guest, Diana Mathangani, who is the Licensing and Administration Coordinator from SongTrust. So how you doing today, Diana?
I'm good. I'm very good. Thank you, Barry, for having me.
No problem. I'm thankful that you were able to carve out some time for me today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, of course. No problem.
So what I like to do always first is just let the guests give a background of who they are and actually how they got into the music business. So can you just let us know those things?
Sure. Well, if we go way back, when I was 5 years old, I grew up in the suburbs of New York. So I was born to immigrants, actually, and they both came here. And obviously, we're very well-rounded in everything, and therefore would like me to perform and take lessons and just be well-rounded. So at the age of 5, I actually took private lessons in violin. And so I was classically trained. I had this older Russian man, and he was like a grandfather, but a very strict one. And I just actually from 5 and elementary school joined the elementary school orchestra, and then like private ensembles, and then did middle school orchestra and high school orchestra. So that was pretty much my main focus. I feel like most people are either sports people or more maybe science people. And so the orchestra was my niche. And so, like I said, I was classically trained. So I went to college and joined that orchestra. And that's when I did that orchestra for 2 years. And then I decided I wanted to kind of focus on my other studies. And so I found like a very small like world music group, and it was maybe like 7 of us max. But it was just like a great time. Like it really taught me more about improv and kind of broke me out of my classical element. So I really appreciate it. Even though that was just like maybe 2 or 3 semesters in my college, it was very enlightening for me. And I just always wanted to have that in the background. And like I said, my parents are immigrants from Kenya. And so when I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, you know, in school for further studies, I kind of was up in the air and undecided. And they were like, well, you know, maybe you should go to school for business, kind of a solid career path. And I took their advice because, like I said, I didn't know that I wanted to be in music per se. And I knew, even though I had performed all my life in school groups and stuff, that I knew it just wasn't for me to be a professional performer. It just takes a lot of commitment and time commitment. And it's just like you have to have that mindset. And I just knew I didn't have it, at least not then. So I decided, all right, I'll take my parents' advice and go into business school. So I went to Northeastern in the business program. And so, like I said, I did the orchestras and the ensembles as an aside, but focused on my business studies. And then maybe around, so Northeastern is great in that we focus on co-op programs, which are basically extended internships. Mm-hmm. And so as a business student, you have to do 3 of them. And it's basically taking 6 months out of your school year to work full time. And you get paid, you work your 9 to 5 or whatever have you. And it basically incorporates your real world experiences with the office life and with classroom work. So so I did my first one in a business setting. It was an office setting. And, you know, I got my business experience there. And then I was like, you know what? I don't know if this is necessarily for me. Let's see if I can kind of interweave my way maybe a little bit more musically for the next one. And I was lucky enough to snag a role at Cobalt in London, actually. And I got to do my second co-op there. So that was my first like kind of music industry work experience. And I was like, okay, maybe I don't want to be fully a performer, but you know, I don't have to be kind of in a cliche stuffy office setting. And I just knew that like pure finance, or both my parents are accountants. I was like, I don't want to do accounting either. So I think that was you know, maybe around my sophomore or middler year was when I kind of was like, okay, this is like a nice happy medium. And so for my third internship or co-op, I was lucky enough to be hired at the Harry Fox Agency, which is like a third party company, which is kind of in between the publishing side and the DSP or digital entities like Spotify. And they basically make sure publishers and writers get paid out. And so I did that for 6 months, went back to school for my last semester. And then I was lucky enough that when I graduated, they actually called me back full time. And that was the official start of my working experience post-grad. And I haven't looked back since.
Nice. So what exactly were you doing at Cobalt and Harry Fox?
So at Cobalt, I was working mainly on the sync side of things, but not necessarily pitching. That it was obviously for the higher ups and people that have been there longer, but I did more of like the backlogging and the labeling of, so when things need to be pitched, they have certain aspects in the blurbs or the summaries where they need keywords to kind of search their catalogs of what music would fit best. You know, you could be there all day if you had to kind of come up with something, but it's like, say for example, I listened to a song in our catalog and I described it as like happy or sad, or like those are very basic, but you tag them based on the melody and like the tempo and the style of it. And once you tag those, then the sync pitchers could then go back into our catalog when someone requests one and basically go in the system and be like, okay, what we need a happy, fast tempo song that has to do with flowers. And you kind of search it, and then based on our tags, you know, certain songs would come up, and then they can listen themselves and pitch it if they deem it fit. And it's just an easier way, so you're not like thinking off the top of your head.
Right. Because that would be, so it's easier for the people who want to license the music to find it based on mood.
Exactly.
Okay, cool. So What made you go into like the sync and licensing world particularly, instead of like, oh, I want to be a manager or an agent, or I want to do touring? How did you get into the side that you're on now?
I think it was, to backtrack, in school, I actually, because I, like I said, I was a business major, but I had leftover electives and I decided to pick up a minor in music industry. I had some friends in it, and, you know, like I've always been interested in the music side. So I was like, okay, I'll take a couple classes. So I did a publishing class. I did a general music industry class. I did a music supervision class, which I actually found very exciting. And I was like, yeah, I think I could get into this. And then I would say with my co-op experiences, like I said, Cobalt was kind of more focused on the sync side of things. And then at HFA, I was focused more on mechanicals and third-party things. So I kind of, it's funny because over the years, like hearing professors, my go-to question was always, how'd you get into this business? Mm-hmm. And like nine out of 10 times, they would say, oh, I kind of fell into it. And it's like, wow, really? Like, okay, that's interesting. And everyone just has such a different story. You know, like if you're an accountant, you basically have to go to school for accounting and get your CPA. If you're a doctor, you have to go to school for half your life and, you know, actually practice it. But like a lot of music people in the industry kind of, you know, have very interesting stories just of how they landed there. A lot of interwoven industries too. So I always found that fascinating, especially for someone like me that's kind of, you know, kind of like a dreamer, and I like to think I can wear all the hats, but then sometimes all the hats seems overwhelming, and it's like, okay, what's my calling? And this one just seemed to fit. So it was a bit of a kind of opportunities that sprung up as well as interests. So.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where until you actually dive into it and get a holistic view of it, you don't really realize how many different things are involved within the music business, especially if you're just looking from like a consumer side, or you just want to be like the artist or the songwriter. You don't know that there's this whole all-star team that's working behind the person you see in front. Like, yeah, there are entertainment attorneys, and then there's agencies that help you book shows, and then there's the manager, and then there's the touring agent. There's like all these different things that you just don't know about before. So I can see how people can just fall into stuff because maybe there's some sort of interest, but they never knew that there was a spot for it within the business.
Exactly. And that going off of what you said, like people maybe that are in law, then practice law, they're like, oh, maybe I want to go more into entertainment law. And then they find themselves at a music house. So they're still practicing law, but it's now more music focused. So a lot of elements, like you have business managers that do music or lawyers that do music, or a lot of things connect well with music. And like you said, kind of even going through the experience, the outside experience, you're like, oh my God, I want to be the next Beyonce, or oh, I can't sing that well. Maybe I can play piano well. And it's like, that's all fine and well, but it for every, major artist, there's just a slews of teams of people that go behind just letting them be in that limelight. And
Exactly.
it's very important too to kind of understand that so that you can appreciate it more,
Yeah, and I think it allows that love for music to still be there. Like, if you don't want to be the person in front and you're just using your skills that you're good at to still be involved within the music field. So I think there's a lot of opportunities out there for people. And this is just one of them.
Absolutely.
So I'm glad to have you here to talk about that, which will
Oh, thank
bring
you.
me to my next questions. For people who don't know, what is music licensing and what types of products or mediums is it used for?
So music licensing basically is the ability for any musician to legally use or interpret another person's works. And so I would say there are three main types, although there's many main types. Like, licensing is such a huge field that you would need me for the rest of the week to fully dive deep into it. But I'll try to stay more topical in general because it can get convoluted. But basically, I like to think of it as into three main groups, which is mechanical licenses, synchronization licenses or sync, and performance licenses. So performance licenses are basically anytime you are in a bar and you hear the music playing, or you're at a venue for a show, or literally any kind of public performance or radio performance, all that needs licenses so that the original creators or rights holders can get paid. Sync licenses are probably the most, I'd say, maybe well known, which is putting music to moving images. So whether it be a movie, film, or TV, or commercial, anytime you have a moving image with music accompanying it, you need a sync license. And then mechanicals, which is what I focus on today at Downtown, that focuses on, well, traditionally back in the day when we had things called CDs and vinyls, as the physical products, you in order for someone to reproduce and distribute those, you would need a license for that. And obviously today it's more focused on the digital side because CDs are waning, although vinyls are making a comeback. They are still relevant, and I do still license for physical products, but yeah, it's probably half and half with digital downloads and streaming and on the digital side.
So do you work with like independent publishers as well to get them licenses or to clear their licenses like as a Harry Fox or Music Reports would, or are you just mainly making sure that the roster that you guys work with have the opportunities to work with different platforms?
So Downtown itself is its own private publishing house, whereas HFA is more of like a third party middleman. So I would say the difference is for Downtown, we represent writers. So we have writers signed to our catalog, whether it's an admin deal or a publishing deal or co-publishing deal. And so we represent them directly. But when we license, we also try to go direct so that we don't have commission taken out But a party like HFA is kind of like a third party middleman, which is good for smaller or more independent publishers, or even big publishers that have like huge catalogs, maybe that just don't have the bandwidth to keep up with it. Especially for purposes like streaming and Spotify aggregations, just is near impossible to calculate all the royalties and everyone that needs to get paid. And that's a big part of what HFA does. So for example, every stream of Halo and Beyonce on Spotify, HFA, all publishers are supposed to register their works with HFA to have the most accurate data. And then HFA collects the money from the digital service providers, and then they pay out based on the information they have. If it's Downtown Music Publishing, and if it's Sony Music, then it's like, okay, well, 50% of the royalties will go to Downtown, 50% will go to Sony. If for whatever reason Sony isn't registered on that particular work, it will just be black boxed until Sony registers with HFA. But in terms of Downtown, we as a publisher, you can sign up or affiliate with HFA to kind of take care of all your needs so you can sit back more. But because we're like an upcoming publishing house, we prefer to take care of licensing ourselves. So we would just say we go direct for any licensees and come by. Sometimes people are like, oh, actually, I licensed at HFA. And it's like, well, actually, we go direct. So if you could, you know, kind of come directly through us next time. So it's a preference thing, just kind of a business deal.
So do you guys do direct licenses with the DSPs?
We do direct licenses for mechanicals. With the DSPs, it's slightly different, just because it's streaming is kind of its own box, but otherwise, as a general sense, we go direct.
Because it's licensed through the PROs, so you guys only have to focus on the mechanicals.
Exactly.
Got it. So my next question is, what is, for people who don't know, who are licensing things in like television and commercials and movies, there's this term called the most favored nations, because there are two rights within the song. And how does that work, and how can someone get leverage when it comes to most favored nations?
I would say most favored nations, or MFN deal, is basically a clause that's in place so that at the end of the day, no one gets ripped off. I would say traditionally, maybe the label side or the master side would kind of be more favored. You know, they have heftier budgets, and they represent the artists, right? So they get kind of that leverage to kind of bargain for more money. And so like traditionally, like the publishers, I wouldn't say go to the wayside, but in order for like the publishing side to not get pushed aside, you kind of agree to the MFN deal. That way it's like, hey, if they're getting 10,000 for this deal, that means we would like 10,000 as well. So it's just to even the playing field, basically.
Got it. Now with the what is it called? The new law that's out.
The what?
The consent decree. Mm-hmm. Have you guys been having an issue with that, with in regards to the writers that you guys deal with? Because you're
not... You mean a compulsory? Or what do you mean?
Consent? Well, just in terms of production houses or any person that wants to license the music, in regards to if your writers are working with larger or more known artists and songwriters, have you noticed the increase in them coming to, say, asking people who may only own like 2% or 5% of the song, and they may be with Song Trust or DMP? Have you seen them come in to get the license from you guys instead of going to the person who, say, owns maybe 80% of the song?
For the sync side, I'm not too familiar with that side. For mechanicals, and correct me if I'm not quite answering question, but for mechanicals, it really doesn't matter if you have 1% or 99%. At the end of the day, everyone kind of has to have a say, and everyone deserves their portion. And at least with mechanicals, it's slightly different in that because it's the statutory rate. It's kind of like a standard based on the compulsory license. As long as nothing is altered, the basic composition of the music isn't altered. Technically, yes, only one party needs to agree, but then something called an NOI or notice of intent will be sent out to all relevant parties and just kind of as a heads up, like, hey, we're using the song, falls under the compulsory license, and it's just a notification saying like this is okay to use. So someone like HFA would issue those NOIs.
Yeah, I guess what I was talking about is specifically for a sync, because I know now they're allowed to go to the person who may have the smallest share within that song. And so instead of going to the person that owns like 80% of the song and that person saying, yo, we want $8,000 to sync the song, they're going to reach out to the person that has like, you know, maybe only 10%, and they're willing to only take $500 for it.
Oh, I see. At the end of the day, like I said, MFN is kind of a clause that you have to all agree on. If that's not in place, for sync specifically, you do need all parties' permission, and everything is negotiable at the end of the day. So yeah, you can start with the person with 5% or whatever, and maybe they only will take 500, but then you still have to go to the person with 95%. And you know, if MFN is not in place, you're dealing with that. And like I said, everything is negotiable, so you can come back and be like, oh well, you know, they gave us 500, so would you accept that? And you know, they have the liberty to come back and be like, no, we don't want that. And if they do say no, then you can't use it. For sync specifically, yeah, you have to have all parties consent.
Okay. Now, with your role in Downtown and SongTrust, what exactly are you doing? Are you helping create the contracts for it? Are you reviewing the contracts?
Yeah. So I focus on the mechanical side, and I do draft the contracts for it. So like I said, we go direct with our licenses. So that means a licensee or a label will come to me and be like, hey, we have this release, and it's coming out next month, and this is the artist, and sometimes they'll send audio, and I'll be like, great. I have to physically draft up the license, and we have our own form for that. And then I would send it back, have them review it and sign it. Sometimes people negotiate specific terms, but overall mechanical is usually kind of standard. And unless the first standard mechanicals, of course, now we're talking about samples and derivative works that kind of veers off into another direction. And I could talk about that in a bit if you'd like, or I don't know if you have a question on that, but
yeah, actually, how are you involved with that clearing process?
Yeah. So for samples, I am involved in that as well. And samples are like syncs in that you need to have the party's clearance. So if we have someone that comes through and is like, hey, yo, we want to use this sample of this work, we know you, first they ask if we administer it, and you know, if we do, then we tell them our share and our writers, and then they'll come back and be like, hey, we want to use this in our new song by Drake. And it's like, all right, well, can you send us the audio for it? Can you tell us how you want it to be used? Can you tell us when it'll be released, on what platforms, how many copies you think you'll sell? And basically, they're giving us all this information. And at the end of the day, we have to send this all to our clients or our writers that we represent. So from there, they either approve or disapprove of it. And we're not at liberty, because we're the publishing side, we're not at liberty to determine that. So I know, like, sometimes, you know, people will come back and be like, oh, you know, why wasn't this approved? And it's like, you know what, I'm sorry, but this isn't, it's not on me per se, you know, it's not on the publishing side. At the end of the day, it's the rights holder's decision for, you know, whatever reasons they want it to be, if they don't want to use it. But that's all negotiated as well. That doesn't fall under stat rate. So that means that if part of our song is used, we were like, okay, I feel like the main melody is used. We want to ask for 65%. So we'll go back and, you know, we'll be like, hey, we want 65% of this song. Do you agree or not? And I would say it depends on whose side is being leveraged. So say our who we're representing is maybe like up and coming, maybe, and whoever's requesting is kind of a bigger artist or bigger name, then they might be like, hey, take what we can get, because we want the exposure, we want the claim, we know it's going to be a big hit, so don't fight on them, because we don't want to lose out on this deal. And they'll say okay. And if the roles reversed, you know, maybe we have a more established client and they're very protective of their work, then they'll be like, you know what, you know, I don't really want to ruin my brand, and this isn't kind of up our alley, so we want to kind of let this one go. Or maybe we want to claim 90% of it and see what happens. So at the end of the day, rule of thumb is everything is negotiable. But I personally like dealing with sample licenses, because A, you get to hear unreleased things, and B, it's a little bit more creative. Mechanicals can be, you know, pretty standard, cut and dry, but samples allow you to kind of have more fluidity and creativeness with what I do. You know, I still want to have that creative element, even though I'm on the back end of things. So, yeah.
So in the examples that you're talking about, are these necessarily you pitching to different artists to use the work? And do you have more leverage when they come to you instead of you pitching the songs to them? Like if someone wants to use the lyrics that one of your clients came up with, if it's a really big artist, are you going to play hardball with them, or are you kind of just going to be like, well, this is a chance for us to get our writers known more? Or are you going to just kind of just take whatever they offer you?
Right. I would say that for the most part, where we stand is usually we receive requests from anyone from your local garage band to, you know, maybe more established artists. And apologize for being vague, but obviously I have to keep some things at bay. But so we do get a wide range, but we usually receive the requests. And usually actually we also get them from kind of middlemen or licensing middle houses or clearance houses. And so they have a rapport with us already, and they're like, I guess they would also be considered the third party, because they're getting your mom and pop shops and everyone else in between. And then they have the direct relationship with us, where as we can kind of be on the same page in terms of what we expect or what we negotiate, you know, instead of being extreme. Of course, at the end of the day, like I said, it's negotiable. If our client wishes it to be double, then that's what it shall be. But yeah, usually we get these requests as opposed to outwardly pitching. I would say our A&R would more so deal with outward pitching, and even the SongTrust side, because, you know, SongTrust is more kind of a one-stop shop for up-and-comers. On their part, it makes more sense to outwardly search for opportunities and then pitch. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of that back and forth balance, and that's the beauty of kind of Downtown and SongTrust, is that it's a kind of yin yang. So like Downtown is kind of like the more traditional publishing house side of things. We get requests, we have a little bit more leverage based on who we have in our catalog and based on how long, you know, they've been out there. And whereas SongTrust, it's kind of like if you kind of can't play hardball with Downtown, like try with SongTrust, I would say.
Oh, okay. I see.
Yeah. Right.
Now, one thing I kind of just thought of while you were talking, is there ever a scenario where someone knows of a writer that you guys have and they're like, I want to see some of the music that they've written that they haven't necessarily put out yet, so it hasn't been like a first use license, or it hasn't been sent as a demo? Does that ever happen? Or someone's like, I just want to see their notepad.
Like a label?
or just an artist or someone who knows of like a great writer, and they're like, I just want to see what they've been working on. Does that ever happen?
To the best of my knowledge, I can't speak directly on that, but I would say that situation sounds kind of like, so we have our Nashville house is kind of like our house of writers, if you will. You know, kind of how sometimes like ASCAP or BMI traditionally have their on-call writers. We kind of have that in that we have a group of writers that write hits for your Blake Sheltons and your Miranda Lamberts and whomever. And so I think, and again, I don't want to misspeak because I don't deal with that directly, but I would say that they probably would deal with more bouncing around of artists that kind of like, oh, I really want to collaborate with that writer or these two writers that I've heard, like I've worked with them before and I think we'd be a good fit. I find that a lot, especially with our country music writers. They kind of, I feel like once you're an established writer and you kind of have that niche or that connection with an artist, then you tend to start writing more for them or for people similar to them, if that makes sense.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question.
But. Yeah, it did.
Okay.
Now, when we talk about licensing music for television and films, what are some of the different factors that are involved when you're coming up with how you're going to draft a contract? Because I've heard things about, you know, is it a background song? Is the person actually performing it in the film? How long are mm-hmm. you using it for? Is mm-hmm. it in the opening scene, the closing scene? Like, how mm-hmm. many different factors are involved?
So this is just for my general sync knowledge. Like, I don't draft our sync license specifically. We actually have another team that does that. We're actually grown super fast, so we have a person for everything. But to the best of my knowledge, yes, it's everything you've just said. Everything in the contract is negotiated, and that ranges from the term of the deal, how long it's going to be on air or on the commercial, where it's being shown. You know, is it just in the U.S.? Is it the whole world? Is it certain territories? Is it that's negotiating, like who's the artist, who's the writer, who, you know, how much are we, how much should they pay for it? Who's also requesting it? You know, is it Beats by Apple? Is it like, is it someone that has the money to just shout kind of? Is it more a mom and pop shop with their homemade video TV commercial? And, you know, it's so many factors. You listed off a lot of them, and it's also the length of the song, you know.
Right.
You can have a 5-minute song, and if you only need 30 seconds of it, that's obviously going to be less than if you need the whole 5 minutes in, say, a movie scene. And a movie differs from TV, which differs from syndicated TV, which differs from, you know, streaming like Netflix or Hulu. So it's so many factors that it's kind of hard to ball up in one clean cut package, but that's
Is there a resource or like a checklist that for the people who are interested in licensing their music, is there something out there that they can go to online or in a book? I remember you mentioned that book by Cohn. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah, I think it's Khan.
Khan, okay.
Yeah, so it's Khan. I have it next to me too, and they actually gave it to me. It's kind of more the business side of things. So although I do think they have some general terms for songwriters, for me it was more helpful in like kind of life terms of licenses, like what wording makes sense to go into licenses. So but for, like you said, writers that kind of want their stuff pitched, SongTrust is definitely off the top of my head, and not biased at all, but SongTrust is a great platform for kind of your everyday writers that kind of maybe aren't signed anywhere and don't really know where to start. Go to songtrust.com, and you know, you can sign up with them, or you can just kind of browse through. They actually have a great Q&A or FAQ, and they really do lay out their policy very clearly, I believe, and kind of easy to digest. Downtown is slightly different because we don't it's like I said, it's more traditional, so we kind of get new writers through the grapevine. It's not just like, hey, my friend's in a band and can we sign them? You know, there's a lot more to it. But if you do have that talented friend, I would say definitely sign up with SongTrust and you know, they'll kind of walk you through that.
So they have someone that will read the contracts for you and explain the terms and conditions, like if someone is interested in licensing your song for a film.
Right. So they'll, and I believe, don't quote me on this, but I do believe they actually kind of hunt for placements for their signed writers. And I think it might be tiered kind of, like, I think you can still own your own stuff. That's the whole point. You do own your own music and masters, but the point of signing up with SongTrust, they take a cut, but they get to kind of source those places or contexts that you otherwise wouldn't have. And that's how they help you there.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, you still own everything. So.
And they have a certain fee, right? Is it like 10 or 15% when you sign up with them?
I'm not sure of the actual percentage, but it is a commission based. But it's probably on the website, or even I know they have. We have a whole team that are focused on client services. So if you have a question, you know, you can hit them up. I believe their contacts are also on the website, so you can easily chat with a real person, and that's not just a bot. So
cool, right?
So
much better.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, with your experience in seeing some of these contracts, is there are there certain terms and conditions or even price ranges that you're seeing that may be specific to indies versus major label artists versus a mid-level artist? What are some of those numbers looking like? Like if I'm just a garage band and I'm getting something licensed, a major film company coming out with a huge movie, are they just going to offer me $500 because I don't have a name yet? Or would it be like $5,000 versus a superstar who may get upwards of $100,000? What has been some continuous numbers that you've seen over the time?
So again, because I don't handle those numbers and license directly, I can't give exact figures. From my general knowledge, I know that it's a two-way street. It's if you are an indie film producer, you don't necessarily have the budget to give, and you know, as much as you might want to use Beyonce's whole roster in your film, it's just not realistic to clear. So that's when you would go and fish for whether it be a sound alike or whether it be you know, maybe a SongTrust writer, for example, something you've heard, or someone on SoundCloud. It's easier to negotiate down, and you kind of at least on the pitching side, it's kind of like, hey, I would say just be upfront, like, hey, this is our budget and we really can't afford much more, like, is this something you can work with? And I actually had a friend recently do a deal that way, and he was kind of uncertain if he should take it or not, but you know, because he is starting off, it's like, why not? This is a good opportunity. You know, you're still building your brand and you're still making a name for yourself. So you know, he was kind of worried of is it bad if I go with whatever fee they started? Should I play hardball? And you kind of have to be honest with yourself and where you are at. And if you know you're just getting started, I would say, I don't want to say like take whatever it is, because you obviously it has to fit with your morals and goals and vision in terms of the product itself, or you know, whatever they're selling, if it's commercial or whatever scene it is. You know, if you're not really personally for that, I wouldn't say just go ahead and take whatever, you know, to put in your pocket. But if it does seem to fit otherwise, it's like, okay, maybe you're not getting, you know, a month's worth of a paycheck for this deal, but it could give you that exposure that you need, and, you know, take this one and maybe they'll have a contact for you. Like, hey, I worked with him last time and his music's dope. Check him out. And maybe that next film or TV company would be like, you know, we can offer him a little bit more and kind of gain traction that way.
Right.
Kind of like what I was saying before with Sinks, it's obviously the more popular you are, the more famous you are, the more the bigger your repertoire is, the more leverage you have. And so it's kind of on both sides, like what you can afford, whether it's the publishing or the licensing house can afford to pay you versus what you are willing to accept.
Right.
So everything's negotiable.
Yeah, because I read a book about publishing, and there's like, you know, people have different ideas in regards to how songwriters should approach it, because you don't want to be known as the person in the industry that will just give out your music for free.
Exactly.
Because people will continue to approach you and just say, hey, you'll get a credit here. Or, you know, if the music, I mean, not the music, if the movie or the television show gets picked up, then we'll come back around and do it. And sometimes that never happens. But then you already have this name within the industry of, oh, you can go to this person and they'll give you the music for free. And mm-hmm. then on the other hand, you could feel like you're missing out on an opportunity because you just don't know what's going to work or what's going to be a hit or not. And mm-hmm. so it's always kind of this battle of what do I do? Do you ever have to guide any of your clients, or do you have people within the DMP and Song Trust community that tell people when they should take those opportunities or not?
So on the downtown side, it's we can, for the publishing side, you know, we kind of we'll read and review everything that comes through. We won't just be like, no, absolutely not, you know, because like I said, at the end of the day, it's not our decision to make, it's the writer's decision to make. And we can, for example, for, well, I can't be specific, but for a sync one, I remember talking to my colleague about, and they had gone through the process of negotiations, and it was for a Netflix show. And, you know, they kind of did the standard, like, yeah, that sounds good. And then the actual show came out, and our client wasn't too pleased because they felt they didn't have enough information, and they didn't know exactly what the storyline was about. So when they, the way it was kind of presented was more innocent than the outcome or the output. So there, you do run into things like that where it's like, of course you don't want to, you don't want to say yes to everything. And, but you also want to have as much information about what you're agreeing to as possible. And that's where we come into play, because we do have to ask all these questions and kind of gain as much information as we can in order to deliver it on a plate for the writer to make their decision easier. But yeah, sometimes it's just things get lost in translation. Yeah. Whether it's the requester being a little shady about it, or whether, you know, you took it as one way and they meant it as another way. Sometimes it's just a matter of wording. So as the publisher in the middle, we try to kind of weed out all the pertinent information that's necessary, so that everyone's, you know, agreeing on all terms.
Now, is there just not a system in place that allows the publishers to view the finished work before it actually comes out? Or is that just something that you just have to request and then they'll be open to it?
We always try to request, like, if, like, hey, do you have a snippet of a scene, or do you have maybe a prior season that we can base your theme off of? In terms of like sample licenses, we always ask for audio and lyrics if you have them written out already, because we want to give our clients, we want to protect our clients, and we want to give them as much information as possible, so that it's not this oh, how about this? Do you know what this is? Oh, let me go ask. Oh, how about this? Do you know what this is? Oh, let me find out. You know, it's like we try to gather all information. And of course, you know, the licensee is also trying to be protective of their work. So they're not necessarily going to send you, you know, the whole 5-minute MP3 or the whole TV scene, because, you know, they're trying to be protective. They don't want to give away everything if you haven't even agreed.
Right.
So you kind of have to balance that and understand that, you know, even the like for example, hire clients that we've gotten sample requests from. It's like, I don't want to send you audio, but can you listen over the phone? And it's like watermarked and you're listening over the phone to kind of approve. So they are allowed to obviously kind of protect themselves as well, but understand that if a client can't gauge the content they're agreeing to, then, you know, might hurt the licensee in the end. So it's kind of a balancing act. Usually people requesting are pretty clear cut about like, here's some audio or here's a scene description. That's like a given. You should know that going in if you're requesting a license, that would be information they need. No one's going to sign blindly to whatever.
Right.
So.
Now, this question maybe you might be able to answer, maybe not because it's out of your division, but do you know what the criteria is in terms of how DMP picks up their clients? Because I'm asking this question for people who may want to look at them as an option to sign with.
I think for the downtown side, it's a little more traditional, as in we have like an A&R kind of searching and scouting. It's not really like anyone can just sign up and send their repertoire and their resume and like, hey, can we sign with you guys? You know, it's not, there's no like simple way. But usually what my response to that is, if you can't get in touch with A&R or to send a demo, you know, if you do have an inside connection, sure, it doesn't hurt. We can always forward things. But as a general rule of thumb, I wouldn't say that, because then they would be inundated all day with demos. So I would say that's like kind of A&R's job to scout, and we leave them to it. But if you are an independent writer or artist, definitely sign up on the Songchess side. And then from there, you get the same basic tools you would need without being, you know, kind of poached and signing up with the, you know, label. It's the same way as like, hey, either like Sony signs you or, you know, you sign up for an indie, or you kind of go through like CD Baby as your independent distributor, you know. So there's no right or wrong way. It's hard for me, of course, to say on the downtown side. That's a little more traditional. But I would definitely say, you know, hit up Songtrust and, you know, sign up through there. You got to start somewhere. And sometimes it does happen where if we do know, for whatever reason, if maybe a song does really well or a writer does really, really well on the Songtrust side, you know, we hear it too, obviously, on this side of things, and it could be picked up that way, to be pulled into the downtown umbrella.
Now, with you being involved in a lot of the legal stuff in terms of how the contracts are written, are you also listening to the music as well before you actually like put the contract together? Like, is that part necessary, or do you just have to understand the language when it comes to drafting it, the contracts?
I would say for straight mechanicals, I don't necessarily need to listen to anything, because that all falls under the Copyright Act. And at the end of the day, it's kind of, like I said, a cut and dry thing. It's, hey, I need to use this. I could ask for audio and lyrics just so I know that it's not like a remix or an arrangement, a separate arrangement, but that's pretty standard, and so I have a standard agreement for it. Sometimes people will come back to me after I send them the standard agreement, like, oh, can you change this? Like, for a lot of people want like the lyrics reprint, and we have a clause in there. You know, when you're drafting a license, it's like you have everything you need in place, but there might be to cover ourselves, we have everything we need in place, but a requester might come back and be like, hey, I noticed you say you need to collect quarterly. Is it all right if we change it to semi-annually? Like, because I only collect and pay out, you know, twice a year. It's like, okay, I can go back and change that clause, because it's not, you know, it's like a small thing, but yeah, for mechs, usually it's pretty straightforward. Samples, it's definitely, I definitely need to hear the audio. And the agreement itself is dependent on what we've negotiated. So I need to know who our songwriters are and the newly negotiated splits, because it could be like the original song is 50-50 and we have 100% with our two writers. But now I need to change the sample agreement to show that it's no longer 50-50. It's maybe we took a 50% cut of the total. So now 25-25, and now we have two of the new writers for the new song, and they're getting 25-25. And this agreement needs to show, you know, all the parties involved, all their contacts and affiliations, and basically have a signatory line that says that all parties approve.
Got it.
So the sample.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry. So the sample just is a little bit more of a tweaking in terms of, you know, what has been negotiated.
And the reason why I was asking that is because I was wondering if there was a certain style or a genre or maybe even certain lyrics that you're noticing that are getting more opportunities than others.
I think that would be more sync-related observation, just because we don't, you know, quote unquote, discriminate against the type of music that comes through. It's if you want to send us a country song to if you want to send us a rap song.
Well, not specifically for you guys, but in terms of the music that's getting requested. So from your clients.
Oh, like from our catalogs?
Right. So when you're looking at it, you're like, man, this is like the fifth country song today that wants to be, you know, licensed. So that's what I was asking.
Kind of thing. I see. Well, for samples, I would say I would definitely see more of either hip hop beats being sampled, or usually it's hip hop songs that use kind of more indie creative kind of indie pop music within it, because it's like, okay, you can have a straight rap song, right? And you got your lyrics and you got your hooks and whatever it is to make that up. And then you have your simple beat, right? But how do you make it stand out? Whoa, I listened to that Hiatus song, and I really like how she uses the drum with her voice. It's so melodic, and so I want to cut snippets of that and put it into my song to make it stand out. So I would say that it seems like a lot of the collaborations seem to be more hip-hop with elements of other, to put it simply.
Got it. Now, do you ever run into situations where, like, newly signed writers come to you guys and they don't have the business in order? Do you help them, like, get their splits together and things like that? Or is that, like, another division that will help them with that?
To get their what together?
Their splits. Their split sheets, like, is that because you wouldn't know who to pay or who owns what if they didn't have, like, the splits, like you were talking about earlier, this writer owns 50% and that writer owns 50%. Is there ever a case where someone wanted to license something, but the paperwork hadn't been finished yet? Is that something you go back and fix, or is that another department?
So if someone's requesting, if, you know, a label hears word of a new release that they know of, but we don't have, splits aren't registered yet, we would simply just go to our writers and be like, hey, have you guys figured out what the final split will be? And sometimes they're like, oh, we're still negotiating, and you know, and we kind of have to keep the licensees at bay until it's decided. That's not something we would decide. We would never go and be like, oh, just give them 100. And it's like, wait. So we always go back to our clients and they're the ones kind of figuring out what, you know, because a lot of times, you know, we might even get it like, hey, it was a 3-way cut. And then they're like, oh, actually, you know, Mark came into the studio and decided to throw on another verse. And so now he's getting 10%. So there are times where it either switches or something's too new where we do have to either wait and confirm. And we just simply go back to the licensees and be like, hey, sorry, we don't have this in yet, but we'll get that to you as soon as we have that cleared.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, are there any websites or any companies that you know about that a person could pitch their music to that is legit? Because I see like a lot of these different companies out there, and a lot of them seem like scams and they're making people pay money up front for people to listen to their music, but they're not really getting opportunities or probably even getting their music listened to. Do you know if there's anything out there that has been helping people actually get their music licensed?
In terms of getting it pitched, or do you mean just like getting exposure,
I
like a
guess both,
SoundCloud?
like pitch. No, not SoundCloud, like in terms of being in film and television. I know that's not particularly your side, but just wondering if you know of something like that.
Yeah, I would say that it's easy. I don't know of standalone websites where you can kind of do that. It's easier when you are signed with a publishing deal or sign up for someone like Songtrust, because then our part of our job is to actually, kind of either poach or kind of, market the catalogs we do have, and so people would see it kind of either through the grapevine or through contacts. So, if you are an indie writer, you sign up for Songtrust, they're gonna go and kind of fish for the right opportunities for you. And it's legit because you're signing up for your annual fee or whatever it is, and you still earn your masters, and you still earn your writing share. But it's like the whole point of you signing up for the publishing side is to help you with that. And I don't know personally of any kind of one-off pitching sites. I think there are third-party clearance houses, and a lot of things I would say are word of mouth. My friend, for example, that I said got a sync pitch for, was it was an indie film, and they kind of it went through actually like a friend of his saw it on a Women Music is a great tool. Women Music is actually really awesome to sign up for. You can join even if you're, male. It's not just for women, but
Oh, I didn't know
sorry, yeah, nothing. I
That's
sound
funny.
like I'm plugging right now, but it's
Hey.
actually a great source just for anyone in the industry to kind of intermingle or network, or you could anyone can email in the group, and once you're accepted and you pay your dues. I actually got this downtown. I saw the downtown job description via Women in Music. So it's that kind of thing I would say is a better resource, kind of people in the know that can kind of point you in the right direction or put you in contact with someone they know, rather than, I guess, Googling.
Right.
I don't know what people are Googling, how to pitch my music.
Right. Yeah. It seems like it could be a little tough if you don't know someone, you know, so.
Right. So something like I would steer more into the side of networking or signing up for something like a Women in Music or any kind of really networking type of group, and go from there. Even if it's like a Facebook group or what have you, because from there you can kind of, spread the word, get your website up, get your music out, and kind of make the connections, hopefully organically that way. And yeah, that's my pro tip.
Yeah, something that kind of just builds a community, like the more people that
Exactly.
join it, that's cool. Now,
Right.
with you being able to see all of the contracts that are going on, are you noticing like a lot more independent, and when I say independent, not necessarily like independent filmmakers, but like a Hulu or Netflix are bringing more opportunities than like a big Sony Pictures or Warner Film? Have you been seeing that lately?
Again, I don't know the numbers, but from what I've observed, it seems like, especially with the digital side growing and the kind of more straight to consumer type of deals happening in the market, like your Netflixes, your Hulus, I think those opportunities are coming in more, especially because they're also trying to build it. Obviously now they're well known and have hefty budgets themselves, but I think especially when they were starting off, they were trying to gain the market share and, you know, doing most of the pitching and offers for getting music placements. Whereas I'm no expert here, but I would imagine a bigger, more traditional film house is either more selective or has maybe a direct connection with like a clearance house. And they usually have their own personal like music supervisors that kind of do the picking and selecting, almost like their own personal A&R, picking and selecting what they can use because they have that budget, they have that allowance to have that. But for your someone like Netflix or anything kind of up and coming, I think I see those a lot more because you know, you can deal with them a little more directly.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.